and welcome to On Sacred Ground on the LMC Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting the voices of the land and of the dead by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and if you are tuning in online and finding yourself having some technical issues, remember that you can listen to the show by calling in via your phone or Skype to 657-383-0525. That's 657-383-0525. And to those of you who are listening live and are in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com, welcome and thank you so much for joining in. This is our 10th episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting live at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific on this March 7th, 2015. And on this episode, we have a very special guest, Witch Doctor Utu of the Dragon Ritual Drummers, a world-renowned pagan drum group, the Niagara Voodoo Shrine. He is one of the founders of that, and he's a member of the New Orleans Voodoo Spiritual Temple. And today he's joining us for a discussion on Life of Legend, Harriet, Mama Moses, Tubman. But before we get to that, as we do every show, we'll be beginning with a poem from the book Earth Prayers from Around the World, 365 Prayers, Poems, and Invocations for Honoring the Earth. Earth brings us into life, nourishes us. Earth takes us back again. Birth and death are present in every moment. Harriet Mama Moses Tubman was born in 1822 and died March 10th, 1913. So we've been planning this episode for some months now, knowing that the death anniversary of this incredible life of legend was going to be right around the time that this episode would be airing. Over her lifetime, she participated in what I understand to be 19 rescue missions over a period of 10 years, having been born into slavery, escaping to the North, and returning to the South time and time again to eventually free over approximately 300 enslaved people at the height of the movement that she was carrying out. There was a bounty of $40,000, dead or alive, on her head. Let's call in the experts, because I can only speak from what I've been told through the American public school system, which I'll leave it at that. But please welcome Witch Doctor Utu. Thank you so much for joining us today. You are an expert on the life of Mama Moses, and you have something to share with us that I'm sure 99.99% of people simply have no idea about.
All right. Well, I don't know about expert, but certainly a hardcore enthusiast. So let me just get that out of the way. But yes,
thank you so much for joining
here, brother.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to start with a quick question. Where are you on the North American continent? And because I know that we're talking about a regional experience, a trans-regional experience. So let's just start there with where you are. I feel like that's a great place to begin.
Yeah, man. Well, I'm talking to you right now from St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada, and that's the town that Mama Moses set up shop, so to speak, when she did flee bondage in the South and took up in the North for a little while in New York State. She eventually, because of the Fugitive Slave Act that was eventually enacted to allow bounty hunters to come back and retrieve escaped slaves, retrieve freedom seekers and bring them back to the South, she had to get out of America and ended up coming over here into St. Catharines, Ontario. This is where she set up shops, where she lived for almost 15 years, not far from where I am right now, actually. And there's a little neighborhood that they were calling Little Africa for a while. And the shelter she took up in there was in the British Methodist Episcopalian Church. Back then it was still the African Methodist Episcopalian Church, but that's where she set up. That was the house of worship that she utilized for numerous reasons, obviously for prayer and for solace, but also for planning and for social gatherings. It was just that she lived on that block for the whole time. And every time she left to go back into the South, as you said at the beginning, to retrieve, beginning with just family members and other freedom seekers that could meet up with the various rendezvous spots that she went to, that's exactly where she brought them back. Through all the hardships, through all the swamps and the marshes, hiding on railway cars, the whole nine yards, she ended up back right here in St. Catharines. And so there's a whole legacy of her in this town where I live in, which is ultimately the reason why I was sort of guided into working with her as a spiritual force. It was not really my choice, but it's how it happened. So I'm talking to you from. I'm talking to you from the end of the Underground Railroad, her track at least, because there was many tracks that went to many different parts of Canada. But I'm talking to you literally from blocks from where she stood, walked, talked, preached, planned, and got ready to fight for freedom.
And this is right by Niagara Falls, correct?
Yeah, to drive to Niagara Falls from here is about 15 minutes. And that is where she crossed most of the time. She most of the time did cross across the suspension bridge from Niagara Falls, New York, into Niagara Falls, Canada. And the reason that St. Catharines was ultimately chosen, because there was a few settlements in Fort Erie, which is actually a little farther south in Canada, closer to Buffalo, and why Queenston Heights, which is on the other side of Lewiston, New York, because there's three border crossings where I live, and each one is a little closer than the next, Buffalo being the farthest away, is because St. Catharines was just far enough that when bounty hunters would cross the border to come and try to retrieve slaves that got away, that St. Catharines was just far enough away that if that happened, they could be caught before they could get back over to the United States side. They could get messages through, they could get alarms off, and they could stop it from happening. So it was just far enough away that there was relative absolute safety for her and for her people.
That's incredible. So so you're living in a town that has this cultural legacy. There's a strong memory of her. Here we are, 102 years after her passing. But was there a spiritual legacy or some kind of a cultural tradition surrounding her life as well? Or were things sort of more secular and then you sort of began, or sort of how did that happen? Did you sort of join a group that was already existing or join a tradition that was already existing?
Well, I'm still piecing that all together. I discovered her as a spiritual force around the year 2000. And I certainly didn't begin it by any stretch of the imagination. But, I mean, honestly, the moment that she passed away and was buried, and she's buried in Auburn, New York, which is a couple hours from here, so on the American side where she's buried, her grave instantly became a place of pilgrimage. It became a place of a Mecca-like journey. People that were free or new or family members or just people who had a respect for her from all over started to come to her grave. And so almost immediately she was, however you want to relay it, whether she was expanded or she was elevated, but through her funeral was a religious ceremony where people commemorated her. And to this day, her grave is a shrine. It's a place where people make pilgrimage for numerous reasons, whether they're the historical or if it's for, to trace family roots or just to acknowledge for many Black Americans and Canadians to just go to this grave. So almost immediately, because of the nature, especially if the people that lived up here, which is predominantly the African-American community of people that, transplanted themselves up here via the Underground Railroad or moved back into New York State, whatever the reasons, many of these, because you got to think that she did bring a few hundred people quite possibly into freedom, into Canada. But the Underground Railroad brought about anywhere from 30 to 50 to 100,000 Black Americans into Canada and into the North in particular, into this region that I call home, which is it starts from Rochester, New York, moves through Buffalo, Lewiston, Niagara Falls, New York, and right into where I am now. There's a huge settlement of freedom seekers that made their home in a place about another 2 hours southwest of me in London, near London, Ontario. It's called Chatham, Dresden. Huge, huge community. All historic, beautiful old buildings, and that was kind of like a utopian sort of, that's what they referred to it as, a utopian society that they built, again, in freedom, because where they were down around that corner, they were coming through Windsor from Detroit into Windsor. And so that was, again, just far enough away to prevent bounty hunters from gathering. So right away, she is remembered. The reason, and so the amount of people that came up here, they brought along with them the folk beliefs of what was going on in the plantations. you know, and for people who came up here all the way from as far south as Louisiana, Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, you know, they didn't all come up, obviously, through Harriet Tubman's route, but they came up and they made their way. Sometimes it took them over 2 years to make that journey to get into this region. And so automatically when people who owe her or other people, because she's not the only one that is commemorated, invoked, worked with, prayed to, asked for help to, numerous figures in this region where I live of the various aspects of the Underground Railroad. Their graves are shrines. There's plaques to them. There's statues to them. There's descendants who remember them. Their names are uttered still to this day in churches around here. You know, they're commemorated on days of their death, days that they had great achievements. These people are still remembered. They're still worked with. They're still prayed to by various facets of people and various facets of religions. So it's been going on up here for a long time in fragments, and that's how I discovered it, by happenstance. And I just became, you know, enamored with it, mostly because I was working on a voodoo tradition, and it was for me to discover it was really because I'd already become a drummer for the voodoo temple in New Orleans. And that was really the only reason I got involved in voodoo or conjure of any kind. It would have been the last thing I would have thought I'd ever get involved in back then, I can assure you. And it was only because I was a drummer, and there was a need for drummers back then for various people. There wasn't, the internet wasn't really, you know, something that everybody had, so it was phone numbers, word of mouth. I had a crew of guys that I drummed with. We traveled all around, and we did our service for numerous different types of ATR traditions, you know, all kinds, even Native American, the ceremonies we drummed with as well. We just, wherever we were needed, we went. And so eventually, some people from the Voodoo Spiritual Temple in New Orleans who came up to stay up here with me for a little while in St. Catharines, they were the ones who told me about it. Because Priestess Miriam, all the way, a woman who was born, Priestess Miriam, who runs the Voodoo Temple in New Orleans, born in Mississippi, lived all over America until she returned to the South. She was aware of Harriet Mama Moses Tubman, Frederick Douglass, the whole, all of them. And so it was them that told me, hey, you know, you do realize that if you're going to, you know, you're going to try to connect with us and keep coming back and forth to New Orleans, that you should be doing some voodoo, some conjure work, some root work in the area you live in. And I was like, oh, yeah? Well, how am I supposed to do that? And they're like, well, Harriet Tubman. At the time, again, I lived right around the corner from the church. I lived in that neighborhood. And so they're the ones, actually, all the way from Louisiana that pointed it out to me. And almost immediately, I knew about the place. I know that. I knew that place existed. But even myself, just because I wasn't really like an all-knowledgeable person on how conjuring or voodoo or hoodoo or various things ended up where they did, I had no idea. And all of a sudden, a light bulb went off. I'm like, oh, okay, the Underground Railroad. Oh, yeah, of course, it makes sense. And so it just became that. Then I made a relationship with the people that run the church, the historians, the some of the people that run, you know, keep this the community going. They're all descendants of people that made it to freedom here in town. And, yeah, so that's how I ended up being immersed in it. And then just because of my ability to travel a lot with my bands and with various other things that I do in life, I just made it a passion to follow as much as possible backwards the route of the Underground Railroad to various numerous places, numerous towns. I've spent years staying in people's homes, staying in you know, temples, and talking with people, connecting with people, and learning what it is, like how, what part of the Underground Railroad is it about them that they're connected with, and realizing that there's an entire fabric, just, but it's all isolated. It's just little bits and pockets of wherever the Underground Railroad went, left a legacy of some sort, a figure to venerate, some sort of a practice that was left behind. Just some sort of a legacy of songs, type of whatever form of religion, you know, whatever form of Christianity was being there at the time. It's all interwoven and interconnected to where really, when you see it, because of the Underground Railroad being so many figures, black and white, different religions from Quaker to Jewish to Protestant and Catholic, all, and Native American, all interconnected to make the Underground Railroad what it was, that it's an entire fabric, it's an entire spirit world, all interconnected. People that worked together, raised money together, helped hide people in their homes, helped usher people to freedom, all sat in each other's different houses of prayer, whatever they were. They all joined together for this fight for freedom, and it was a fight for freedom. You know, a lot of the romantic stories aren't exactly what they were. There were a lot of people helping each other, no doubt, but man, a lot of these people that made their trek to freedom, it was an arduous journey, horrible conditions, chased by dogs, and a lot of them didn't make it. A lot of them perished along the way, of course. And so that is how I ended up in it, just because I was invited into the tradition in a way through North American voodoo, ended up walking into this, and then just continued to be given more mysteries, more invitation, more stuff, and that's how I ended up in this. And you know, I look back now 15 years later, completely a legacy of my work has been all about Mama Moses venerating her. And even in the year 2000, actually, which is odd, right about the time that I really dove into this, simultaneously because of the millennium celebrations around the world, her people, Harriet Tubman, her mother and her grandparents, they know this, that they came from Ghana. They were Ashanti people. They know that. And that's why there's a bit of a trace to her as far as root work or some sort of form of divination conjure that she did work, is because they were Ashanti people. And the royal family in Ghana, they made her the only and the first and only queen mother made posthumously in the year 2000. She's a revered ancestor. And they did that in Africa, in her homeland. So right away, when it comes to veneration of spirit, if your people, if your tribe, if your nation in Africa posthumously makes you queen mother, not just a revered ancestor, queen mother, that's a big deal. And that carries a big shockwave throughout the entire realm of spirit. And that is why so many things have happened in these last 15 years. More plaques, more statues, more commemorations of her have been done in the last 15 years than all the years combined. It's in motion. It's a manifest motion right now.
I mean, you just said about seven different things that just blew me away. First of all, I love what you're bringing to the table, because I know that up until my conversations with you, I think a lot of people... they think the Underground Railroad, they think, you know, a line. Like, they think one line that people, you know, that some people walked to make something happen. And you're saying, like, no, there was an entire web, an entire fabric going all across the United States, even, you know, going out west, that there are Underground Railroad paths that headed directly to the Bay Area, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they went right to... From the South, yeah, that was because of one individual. Well, there was always so many, but one individual in particular, Mary Ellen Pleasant, who was an abolitionist, but she was also a conjure woman. She was married to a white man, ended up, for whatever reason, living in New Orleans for a few years. The debate is up to whoever else, historians other than me, but rumors, and there's books published saying that she somehow was in the city at the same time as Marie Laveau. Whether that's true or not doesn't matter, but... she was in New Orleans. She was an abolitionist. She was helping with her money, because her husband was wealthy, to usher people to the Northwest as opposed to straight up, you know, because it was just made more sense for her. That her connections was able to usher people in that direction. And then there's an entire legacy and neighborhood in parts of San Francisco that, oh, that's why it's kind of like almost, it's not a sister city, but New Orleans and San Francisco have a connection as far as totally, 100% related to the Underground Railroad by people who sent folks that way as opposed to northeast, they went northwest. And in fact, in a part of San Francisco, still stands to this day a plaque and a tree, a eucalyptus tree that Mary Ellen Pleasant planted herself. That was in her garden. And people go to that tree and they use it for purposes of magic, to commune with her spirit. Again, there's something that's so tangible. One of her trees, this woman who helped so many people. She eventually fled New Orleans and had to go live in San Francisco, because that was how it had to be done, because she was also wanted. Anybody that helped with the Underground Railroad, if they were sort of just enough within hostile territory, they were doing this at great risk of losing their fortune, their lives, or to be imprisoned or something. So they went in all directions that the railroad went, right?
So there's this sort of intersection taking place between spiritual practice and conjure and abolitionism and people who are sort of enacting maybe the sort of like warrior role of leading people, you know, many people, not just Harriet Tubman, but many people, and many of them being led to where you are geographically right now. And you mentioned that it's not just Harriet Tubman, but other people are also invoked. So would it be accurate to say that there's a regional form of conjure where you are, in which individuals who were leaders of the Underground Railroad are invoked in people's private, in addition to public, because you mentioned also churches and commemorations that are sort of town-wide, but also invoked in people's private conjurations and spells and endeavors in their lives?
Yeah, like you name the person, and whatever region, that mostly it's where the people are buried. So I can speak best case of what I know the most is New York State. New York is essentially the capital. New York State is the capital of the Underground Railroad because so many of the most prominent figures live there, and a lot of them are buried there to this day still. So even some of the ones that died down south, they were transplanted up and buried in New York State for lots of reasons because they wanted to protect the bodies. So even John Brown, the great John Brown, is buried in New York State. Frederick Douglass, Harry Tubman, I couldn't even count how many. So it is regional. It is because of, questions I don't have the answer to, how certain towns, I'll use Rochester as an example, with when people are starting to like practice whatever form of conjure, voodoo, hoodoo, there's a very large community there. It's a little more multi-ethnic than people give credit, and it's got a lot of culture. That town is like Underground Railroad capital, and it doesn't take long for people to just start to connect the dots and realize that, here's a figure. Again, Frederick Douglass, who's buried in Rochester, who is also one of the most prominent figures in the Underground Railroad, was a friend of Harriet Tubman, was a friend of John Brown. Some of the most prominent warriors, that's the best word for them, they were warriors, all knew each other. They talked to each other. They sent letters back and forth to each other. They looked each other in the eyes, many, many times, and sat and talked and planned, and would see each other off and on. So, it doesn't take long until people can start to piece that together and start to use them. I've discovered on my travels, I've walked into voodoo houses, Santerian places, that temples that literally have Harriet Tubman and other forms of people from the Underground Railroad as their Oguns. I was stunned. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. They tell me why. So all the way down to the Carolinas, because anybody who is living in their region, even all the way down south, if their people or people in their family or their legacy, they know they went north. It's in all the spirituals, right? It's, to me, the Underground Railroad and that fight for freedom, to me, is the most paramount part of any piece of North America. It's North American conjure. Right, because it comes into Canada. It's like Canada seems to be somehow forgotten. I've read numerous books on Harriet Tubman at times where they don't even mention St. Catharines, which boggles my mind. This is in St. Catharines is where John Brown came to here. He came to this town. So when John Brown was moving around from Kansas up into New York and all around Massachusetts to gather up his fighting force to take on and go and invade Harper's Ferry, the famous or infamous Harper's Ferry raid, he came to Ontario. He came specifically to meet Mama Moses, to come and seek her blessing, seek her knowledge of traveling routes, and seek her ability to help raise up a fighting force. He came here. He spent 2 weeks with her right here in St. Catharines, blocks away from where I am right now. And he gave her a moniker and a name that she was so fond of till her dying day, and that was General Tubman. And that is one of the words that is used to invoke her, to call her General Tubman, because she's a fighter. And he gave her the name General Tubman. She wanted to fight in the Harper's Ferry raid. She was going to go. She told all of her inner circle. She had an inner circle of handlers, almost, you want to call them, scouts, protectors, bodyguards. Like, she didn't go very many places by herself. And her whole inner circle, when John Brown left, said, "You cannot go on this raid." Then Frederick Douglass tried to tell John Brown he was crazy. Everybody that knew about this raid said, "This is not going to work out." But it seems like, if you really have to analyze it, John Brown was going to be a martyr. It's what helped kickstart the Civil War. It's what helped bring that bloodshed that just made this happen. I mean, some people debate that he never should have done it, but whatever, that's for other people to debate. He did it. And so Harriet Tubman was going to be on that raid. She had the time. She had the knowledge. She knew what time of the month, when, based on the moon, that she was supposed to be at a rendezvous spot. And to this day, historians debate why she wasn't there. Some people say she was sick, but I can tell you from living here in town, because we have people that are descendants of freedom seekers here, people that are the historians in St. Catharines, they said that her handlers they dissuaded her because she couldn't read. This is the thing about Harriet Tubman, she couldn't read, never did learn. And so when the final pieces of paper were coming through mail to tell her where to be, she knew kind of the idea, they totally gave her misinformation. That's what I am told, and that's what I believe personally too, that the people that surrounded her said, no way. So, of course, John Brown went down to Harper's Ferry. It didn't work out. So, thank God, because if she had went on that raid, well, what would have happened, How many more families would never have gotten their freedom? How many? She was used as a flag bearer at one point to show her as, like, look at this woman. Look at what she's doing. Because she was just one of hundreds of people that did what she did. She just gathered the most notoriety, the most fame for it, and the most legend, and she became almost like the Robin Hood figure, you couldn't catch her. Couldn't catch her. And nobody ever did ever catch her. And she was always very proud that when she was bringing her followers with her, she always said she never lost a passenger on her train, not one single person. But there's a reason for that, because quite a few people on her journeys, when she was bringing them as a leader, many wanted to turn back. And the other reason Harriet Tubman is considered a warrior and people place them in their Ogoons and place them in their Egoons for various reasons is she carried a gun. The moment she became who she was, she had a musket or a revolver on her all the time, 24/7. She never left anywhere, went anywhere without it, unless she was hiding to go in. But, you know, when she was, like, on journey, she had to go into town to sneak in to do things. She obviously had to stash the weapons, but that's why she had the pistol on her. And many times, it's legendary, and it's true, that people were like, I got to go back. You know, I can't do it. I'm going to chicken out. She put a gun to their head and literally said, you'll die free or you'll die a slave. You know, which one's it going to be? You know, you decide right now. Because she could never let anyone get away because they would be tortured. They would give up how she was getting back and forth without ever getting caught.
We're going to be right back talking more about these roles that Harriet Mama Moses Tubman played as warrior, as a spirit woman, and as a figure that is still called upon by individuals right after this upcoming song. Thank you so much again, Dr. Witch. Thank you so much again, Witch Dr. Utu, for being with us and sharing all this information. We'll be right back.
Got it.
Come on, give me some freedom. I want some freedom. Come on, come on, come on, give me some freedom, y'all. Give me some freedom.
We are back on Sacred Ground Radio. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and we have special guest Witch Dr. Uchu. We are talking about Harriet Mama Moses Tubman, affectionately called General Tubman as well, who's quoted as saying during her travels, "If you hear the dogs, keep going. If you see the torches in the woods, keep going. If they're shouting after you, keep going. Don't ever stop. If you want a taste of freedom, keep going." Witch Dr. Uchu, one of the things that you said in the last segment just resonates with me so much. You mentioned both Ogun and Egun. In my understanding, Ogun is an Orisha from the Yoruba tradition found in Ifa and found in the Lukumi Santeria tradition, who is a warrior. And you were sort of, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were sort of saying that in this regional form of conjure where you live, and I'm sure amongst other individuals who might be practicing sort of like New Orleans voodoo and feel called to work with Harriet Tubman, they will include some element of her in their, say, their shrine to Ogun, that's sort of adding her to that element of their practice, that element of the warriorship that they're calling upon in their lives, as well as their Egun, meaning sort of their dead, their ancestors, their revered ancestors that they're calling upon. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, for the Orisha aspect, Eguns for sure. The people that had her in their Oguns, plural, was actually a Haitian voodoo temple. And they're not the only one where they include her as one of the many. You know, now I'm not part of that tradition, so I can't really break that down 100%, but they include her in the many various warriors that are in their Oguns. And they've done ceremonies to do that. I've witnessed one of them, you know, where the gunpowder and her calling her name and the way they invoked her spirit. And this is before they met me. This is before they met me. And so, you know, I was blown away, you know, because, again, it's just the amount of, and for the Eguns, yes. Now, there are numerous aspects of Ifa or Orisha work that I've met, because I'm part of that tradition as well, where they say, oh yeah, we include her, you know, we commemorate her, we remember her. But I've also participated in making that happen, because for many years living here in Ontario with a friend of mine whose name is Prince Bamadili Bajawa, and he's a Yoruba elder. He's part of the Royal House of Abuja from Nigeria. He lived here for many years. He was a mentor to me, a friend, a colleague. We traveled together. We did lots of ceremonies together. He's entrusted to do the Agungun masquer dance of his family and of his region. And so he kind of always sort of taught me, it's kind of funny that, you know, ceremonies are done on the corner of any street. That is, you bring the Orishas anywhere, and they come to wherever you want them to come to, and you can dignify them and honor them anywhere. And so we did a ceremony in Toronto at this legendary old place, a blues house where jazz and blues musicians, black jazz musicians and blues musicians would come up to Canada and play in this place in Toronto, and we did a ceremony where he, on behalf of his royal family, blessed her spirit and commemorated her and included her in their Oguns, you know, in their lineage, in the Yoruba, that he is of royal blood to do such a thing. And so at times, while some people have been throwing pebbles into a pond to make waves for including various aspects of Mama Moses and different spiritual traditions, I've participated in taking a 12-inch block and dropping it into a puddle, you know, like kablam. And that was one of those moments. And anytime that I can and I see somebody who's reciprocal and wants to include that and commemorate it, that's a big deal, you know. And so really all I've been doing is connecting with people. It's just been a journey. It's been an odd journey that I'm just trying to connect all dots. And it's almost like, you know, connecting stars. And the North Star being such a prominent figure of freedom, whether that was through lore or not, it really ultimately was something that people did follow to make their way to freedom. They knew that was the direction to go. And so there's astral mysteries involved in that, you know, with the Polaris star, you know, what it means and the stars surrounding it. And so that's kind of how it is for me. It's just to connect all these people and to just continue to give life, to give breath, to give fire to her memory, her followers' memory, her compadres, her allies, all of them, white and black, Quaker, Christian, it doesn't matter, heathen even, whatever they are, you know, they all participated. And again, for me, to look at it as now a practitioner, as a student of conjure and how it moved its way throughout North America, to me, it's the most important fabric. It's the most important foundation because it's something that happened here. You know, it's a movement that happened here. The horrendous situation of the slave trade being brought to this continent, you know, is what it is. Eventually, another thing happened, and that was this fight for freedom because, you know, despite what many people believe, it was a fight for freedom. Many, many enslaved got the hell out of Dodge as fast as they could, and they went north, or they went west, or they went south. They did what they had to do. And this was the defining movement in America to me, you know, as a student of America, looking at it, living on the border, because it ultimately does have legacy right into the country I live in. And so she is included in many. I've seen people talk about trying to elevate her to Orisha status and stuff. You know, there's a lot of people out there doing hardcore work from Africa right to North America and to various parts of the world, but mostly, in, of course, our region, that just continue to elevate her, continue to work with her, continue to honor her, and make offerings to her. And interestingly enough, for her, when people leave offerings for her, you don't leave alcohol for Mama Moses, because she, you know, was very open about she hated alcohol. She thought it was a bad thing. So the last thing you're going to do when you set up a shrine or you're going to do make some offerings or give her sacrifices, you don't include alcohol. You include coffee, water, you know, and you include cornbread. Cornbread was her favorite food till the day she died. People brought her cornbread from all over when they came to visit her, one of her payments, if you wanted to come and talk to her when she eventually was in her retirement phase in Auburn, New York, when she was given a shawl by Queen Victoria. She was very proud of that. The Queen of England sent her personally this famous shawl that she's pictured wearing in her very later twilight years. And so gifts came to her all the time. And one of the things she loved was cornbread. That's her favorite. And she had a real sort of like opinion on good cornbread and what was bad. So for her, it's coffee, water, tea, hot foods, warm foods, sustenance foods, no alcohol. Alcohol on the outer perimeter to some of her followers and some of her aides and folks, because, yeah, everybody likes a little drink. But it's not the obvious where people are like, oh, I'm going to build a shrine or I'm going to work with Harriet Tubman, I better have some rum. Well, that's not going to get a lot of favor from her because she didn't like alcohol, right? So that's just one of those little weird, semantics, you know.
Well, you know, it's all of this veneration of people wanting to elevate her to Orisha status. You know, this is why it was so important to me to make sure that there would be sort of an ongoing segment on the show focusing on Lives of Legend, because, you know, there's definitely the aspect of, you know, being able to call a spirit into one's spiritual work or, you know, just be really inspired by a spirit. But it's I guess for me, it's that inspiration that is so poignant, because what we find is in these Lives of Legend, of which Harriet Tubman is very, very high up in the ranks, such tremendous courage and bravery, but also cunning. And there are a couple of stories associated with Harriet Tubman that really depict that cunning. I remember reading that there was a time where she was on one of her routes, and she saw someone who had, you know, had laid claim to her earlier in her life, and in order to hide from them, she had already been carrying a basket of chickens, and she pulled one of the chickens' legs so that it could go wild and create all this agitation to further hide herself. And that on another experience, she saw another person that had quote-unquote owned her, and she grabbed a nearby newspaper very quickly and pretended to read it, because she knew that, well, that would mark her as not being Harriet Tubman, because that person knew that she was someone who was illiterate. So many heroic actions, you know, can be planned, can be plotted for months and years in advance, but there's also this clarity of the moment that she had, this ability to just simply act from such a clear, powerful place in the moment on her own behalf and on behalf of others, that to me is a call. is a call to be a clear person versus being a two-minded person, to really get your values, to get your values straight, so that, because it's often courage is not what we plan for, it's what's going to happen in that moment. Can we be brave and do the thing that is needed when the time comes? I remember also reading that Harriet Tubman, I believe, knew that she was of Ashanti heritage because she had told someone early in her life about her dreams, and someone said, oh, you're one of those Ashanti women because you dream like that. And I know that dreams were a very important part of her ability to free so many people, that she would dream of the routes that she should take. And in some of your writings, I've read that there were spells of invisibility, protection, and even animal totemic magic that were invoked, I'm sure not just by her, but on the Underground Railroad in general. Can you speak to the active use of spirit work and spells to aid the freeing of enslaved peoples?
Yeah, okay, so you're dead right about all that. She is cunning, she was conjure. And her ability to outsmart, literally somehow, numerous times it's been documented that there was a booby trap somewhere, and somehow she knew, we're not crossing at that river, we're not crossing over that hill, and avoided it, only to find out later that, yeah, someone was laying in wait, and she would have been captured, and everybody else as well. I've talked to a lot of people over the years that run Underground Railroad museums or lodges that are host some of these mysteries, and in particular a couple of scholars, most of them are black, I'll say, especially in America, and I've talked to a few of them and asked, you know, listen, because I've got a book coming out on the subject, but I'll just cut right to the chase. So to talk to other people about it, you know, one individual, I'll just leave nameless for now, who built a very legendary large Underground Railroad museum in America. He's doing his own autobiography. It's not going to have anything to do with the esoteric, but I asked him. I was like, "Listen, why is there never anything really very much written about that?" And he's like, "Well," he says, "it's not something our people really tried to promote very much, you know." And again, you go down to anywhere in the whatever we consider the heart of conjuring somewhere in America, down in the South, you know, wherever people would say, look, see that town or that region or that state, everybody there practices conjure or hoodoo or something. Well, just go to one of those churches in a predominantly black area where supposedly there's a ton of conjure happening and just start walking around asking stupid questions about conjuring hoodoo. It ain't going to work out very good for you. So that's, you know, obviously still not the case up here. It's something that's just kind of, it's always kept under the ground, right? It's underground. That's what it is. And so that's why the practices have always just been sort of regional. So here's the thing about her that you can't find very often in books, is that she was a conjure woman. That's the word. That's the word that her mother was. In fact, her mother was referred to as a witch doctor in particular. Her mother was a diviner, and so was Harriet Tubman. So she divined. Now, she was very spiritual because, just like you said, you know, she had a calling. She said it herself. She was on a mission. She was called from God. She was called from the ancestors. She said those words. Well, at least someone wrote down those words numerous times, so she must have said it more than once. So she was on a mission from God. Her spells, as in fits of consciousness, can be debated. Most likely is because apparently she had a real horrible beating laid upon her by one of her masters when she was a slave that messed up her head a bit, you know, and gave her a form of narcolepsy. She had fits where she just literally passed out, mostly during the day, and she would be unconscious for a while and then come back out. And when she came back out of these fits, she'd have vivid visions. She used bones, she used rocks, she used weather, she used animals, movement of animals, you know, because you got to imagine if you're walking through these paths that somehow harbored her so well and gave her so much shelter, then animal movement must have been a big, I'm telling you, it was a big part of it. So if you, you know, see a lot of animals that maybe, you know, from deer to possum, to raccoons, various animals that aren't going to be around deer, vultures big time, hawks, eagles, things that you know that they fly in certain times in certain areas, And that's even literally woven into some of the spiritual, some of the code poems, some of the code songs about bird migrations, animal movements. People, of course, because of the amount of people that came up from the South that were coming on Freedom, they did everything from, you know, putting graveyard dirt in their shoes, carrying high john in their pockets. Like, that was one of the most paramount ones, carrying the root of High John the Conqueror and knowing his story. Frederick Douglass, even, her friend, and the great Frederick Douglass, who is a free thinker, who although was a spiritual man, still was, to this day, people will debate his actual thought of religion, because he wrote many papers assailing the Christian church for its treatment of black Americans, and it's sort of, it's complete double hypocrisy of how it treats certain humans, not others. But he says, you know, he wrote in his own words, when he made his break for freedom with his colleague when they took off, that beforehand he was told about the mysteries of High John and certain roots and herbs he had to chew in his mouth and carry on him so they wouldn't be seen for invisibility, so they could get away. And he says in his own words, he doesn't know how it happened, but they should have been caught five ways to Friday. And yet he's like, you know, it happened. That the spirit of High John and the story of him possessed me, possessed my colleague, and we made it to freedom. And so he always had a soft spot for that. So many of the workers, the people, because the people that came on the Underground Railroad were from everyone to the guy that dug holes, you know, looked after plants or parts of the planting cycles, which is why so many of them were so valuable. You know, if you're a multimillionaire, because I've worked in my younger days on some farms and tree farms and stuff, and I've seen what would happen if the whole workforce walked off. That farm is in big trouble. So if you were one of the lead hands, and you had the knowledge of how to run the whole plantation, when to plant stuff, how to harvest it, how to keep that workforce motivated, and you took off, it was worth that plantation owner to spend the money to try to get that guy back, because now he is totally screwed. He doesn't know what he's going to do, and his money is in big jeopardy. So for her, she did divine. She divined in multiple ways. All right, and that's a fact, and that is something that, you know, just here in St. Catharines, especially the historians here, because we have people that are descendants. She never had children, but she had adopted children, and some of them live here in St. Catharines. They're friends of mine. She was a diviner, end of story, and other people know this too, because, you know, you go to any public library and take out books on Harriet Tubman or Underground Railroad, it's a small library in and of itself. It's hundreds of books, and you have to sift through, you know, things that you can tell, well, that's probably not true, or this sounds like somebody making something up, but then you get to a quote that you can back up and realize that many, many times when things were getting hard, she also said, we're all going to have to pray right now. And she said, we have to pray in our own way. You pray to your God, I'll pray to mine. We pray to our ancestors, we'll be fine. It literally rhymed. And so it didn't matter, you know, because numerous various aspects of people that ended up coming along her came with their own knowledge of invisibility, caring. But High John was the most important. Carrying snakes, you know, handling of snakes, that was there. They would use them for good luck, pick them up. That was considered good luck to have them. Following vultures, anything that was, you know, what we call a curio now, to carry along with you for your journey, for protection, whatever they are, you name it. You name it from Louisiana over to the Carolinas and everywhere in between. What did different people value as something of power? They carried them with them on a journey that they knew they were about to go on that was going to result in their death, their torture, or God knows what, you know. So they brought with them everything that they had. And Harriet Tubman obviously was learning that more and more, but she used bones and stones that she dropped on the ground. And she used her fits, her spells of consciousness when she came out of it, to all of a sudden have knowledge. And, you know, no, we're not going this way. We're going to have to double back and go that way. Somehow, man, her spirit, you know, just in those moments of her being unconscious, was able to rise, look like a vulture, you know, especially a vulture, to be able to look, see, smell where people were, smell where they were hiding, and then come back into her body where she'd be like, okay, we're going a different way now. And then to be able to circumnavigate and get around these booby traps and get back to freedom every single time. And then, of course, her use of song. She sang. She sang and she talked. Because so many books emphasized her Christianity, well, it had to be a pretty loose form of Christianity because she never could learn to read, you know. It's not because she didn't have the ability. It's because she was just too damn busy. Because after the Underground Railroad, when the Civil War ended, she ended up going down and joining the Civil War as a spy, as a nurse, as a cook, you know, and as a healer. She also is a healer. Her knowledge of herbs and prayer to heal disease was was renowned. She was sent by the Union Army into Florida, where plague was, in Florida, where people were just dying of plague like crazy, but she was able to heal it. And her and some of her fellow healers were able to come in, lay hands, say prayers, administer herbs, eat this, drink this, and use incantation, So I wish I could say the actual source, but I don't know. No one knows, but she did utilize all of those forms, hands-on healing, prayer of some kind, incantation, carrying of roots and herbs, animal parts, witnessing and watching animal movement, because, as any good hunter or any good spy knows, animals, even to this day, if you're hiking out in the woods somewhere or something, and you come across a deer or you come across something, it's like, whoa, you're in a place that you realize, well, obviously, either it could just be by the side of the road, it doesn't matter, but if you know your region and you know your area and you're hiking around, you can also learn animals will show you things, animals will bring you to another dead animal. A bird will bring you to a dead bird where you'll find a carcass. I have a house full of them. A deer will bring you to antlers, will bring you to a dead deer. If you vibrate on a certain level, animals will help you. And since, North American conjure doesn't have a legacy of sacrificing animals for any reason whatsoever, animals were, again, they were legendary. They had mysticism. They had powers because of Br'er Rabbit. Right, the stories of that the rabbit, that was another one of the creatures that, they would use as like, oh, look, it's Br'er Rabbit. There he is. He's leading us on the way. There's stories of all of the animals that could talk and walk, whether they were influenced from the Native Americans, those stories came from Africa, or if it's European bits and pieces that entered into, it doesn't matter how or what, but animals in the Underground Railroad were a big, big part of being helpers, totem friends. I'm using that word totem. They obviously didn't use that term, but that's what they were. They helped them. They helped them. They showed them the way. Or gave them knowledge.
So powerful I was just saying, we had the last couple of episodes we did on the show were absolutely about animal helping spirits, and I was sort of talking about them from a shamanic perspective, but now we're really talking about this conversation where the spirit world meets the earth realm in these times of emergency, So that's just incredible that you're bringing this, to our knowledge and our consciousness, the role that animals played in these routes and in this movement.
It's there's so much to it that it's next to impossible to be able to pinpoint it all. But again, and then even for a skeptic, just has to step back and go, all right, who was making the journey from north to south? The enslaved. What was the predominant folk belief of most of the enslaved? Some form of something blended with some form of conjure, blended with some form of either mostly Protestantism, but because of so many that came from parts of Louisiana and stuff where there was Catholicism involved as well, then what was that blend that already existed? There's no way to argue it. If 30 to 50 to 100,000, because that number is debated, ex-slaves made their way into Canada, or just ended up staying as far north as they could in New York, brought with them their beliefs. Well, yeah, what beliefs did they have down there? Well, they had beliefs of knowing that certain animals, because, again, people weren't sacrificing animals on the plantation unless they were eating them, right? So nobody was, killing animals for good luck. Maybe parts of dead animals, obviously for curio purposes, I don't know if that's the right word, but for totem purposes to carry certain wings, certain bones, certain skins, wearing them, hiding them, consuming them. Whatever it was, whatever was needed, it was all implored, everything.
So what I'm asking, is the book that you're writing only going to talk about General Tubman, or is it also going to cover this sort of wider aspect of spirituality and the use of spiritual tools in the Underground Railroad movement?
Yeah, the Underground Railroad. The whole thing is about the Underground Railroad and connecting the fabric. I mean, because to me, again, I can only to speak for myself, how I ended up in this is because I was invited in because I was a drummer a long time ago and then eventually was invited to partake and participate in a deeper level. So why other people choose to say, oh, I want to get into voodoo or I want to learn conjure, I want to learn hoodoo. I don't know what those reasons are for people. But I find that as an observer, because I'm also have my foot in the neo-pagan world, for lack of better term, since the early 90s, I've been immersed in that movement as well, that you know, I see those trends, and I do my best to make sure that people are getting the truth when they want to, you know, come to a voodoo ritual that I'm putting on or something like that, because I do various types of ceremonies when I travel with the Dragon Ritual drummers. Like, when we travel, and we travel extensively, almost every place we perform, if it's a festival place that we're there for a few days, I ultimately do a workshop, a lecture about the Underground Railroad, because almost everywhere we go, there's a regional legacy of it. So last year we were in Detroit for convocation, and 75 or 80 people came to a ritual where we honored all of Michigan's legacy, all of their legendary figures who are buried, you know, in Michigan, who helped get people from Detroit across into Windsor, where there's two beautiful statuaries, the only two things like it, right at the foot at the Detroit River, across from Windsor, is this beautiful statuary of abolitionists and people about to make their break for freedom. Life-size statues, they're pointing across the river to Canada. On the other side in Windsor, there's a giant thing they call the Gate to Freedom, and there is the woman who's free, standing there with her hands up in these giant columns, and there's people moving for freedom in there. It's a connecting doorway. You know, and we have statuary here as well in St. Catharines, and on the American side, and where Lewiston is. You know, because the funny thing is, to emphasize how regional this is, Mama Moses, Harriet Tubman, bringing people into St. Catharines, meanwhile, from Niagara Falls into St. Catharines, meanwhile, the whole time, in Lewiston, New York, 10 minutes north, right, was an individual named Josiah Tryon. He was a white man. He was a minister at the Presbyterian Church. He had never met Mama Moses. If he even knew who she was, who knows? But there's a statue to him, and his contribution, a giant statuary of him loading people onto a boat, life-size statues, right at the foot of the Niagara River, because this is beautiful. And this is the spirit I work with, too, so much. It means so much to me. The graveyard beside the Presbyterian Church in Lewiston was codenamed the Marble Orchard. And almost everybody inevitably that came through the Marble Orchard came from West Virginia, because somehow there was a connection of people that knew or were friendly, all white, from West Virginia to Lewiston, New York, where they could harbor people all the way up. And when they got to the Marble Orchard, which is codenamed for the graveyard, just, you know, obviously, it's an orchard of marble, every single day, Josiah Tryon would walk into that cemetery and look to see if there was someone hiding there. If they were, he brought them to this house, historic house that still exists, hid them there till it was safe, and then when it was safe, he rode them across the Niagara River. Like, this is downriver. The Niagara Falls is way upriver. This is at the mouth of it coming out into Lake Ontario. And he would row them across to Canada. They'd get out, and he'd come back. He did this so many times. It's hard to tell how many people he rode to freedom. And those people ended up coming right to the town I live in, right into the block of the area that I live in. But it came from a totally different route. And we're talking two places that are 15 minutes apart. But back then, nobody knew nothing. They just, you know, Josiah rode me across. But there was never time for Harriet Tubman to walk over and like, oh, I got to go meet this guy. You know, she was ducking for her life. And this guy was hiding to make sure it never got exposed. The beautiful thing is, he now rests. Josiah Tryon rests in the Marble Orchard, and his grave is a shrine. I go there as much as possible. You know, my partner that I live with, my woman, we live on either side of the border, but we share our homes most of the time. And she lives a couple of blocks from there. And so every moment that I can, I go to his grave, leave offerings, commune with him. And because his contribution was so big that the local museum in Lewiston has this beautiful picture that about, you know, 10 years after the Civil War, when it was all over and he passed away, the Hampton University, it's a black university in West Virginia, their choir traveled all the way to this cemetery, and they sang at his grave. A picture exists of this. Because so many of their people from West Virginia, they knew that somehow they were getting to him. And so they came there to sing to him. And then they did it again in 1992. They came back up there again as a commemoration, and they went there and they sang at his grave again. You know? I mean, I when I talk about this, these spirits, they come into my home, I work with them, I get emotional, you know, because when I think about it, I've tasted them, I've introduced them to so many people when they come to visit. We go to these places and they feel their power, they understand who they were. And, yeah, so the fact that in the tiny area I live in now that there's three separate legacies of how people came right into St. Catharines. Harriet Tubman was only one part of it, only one single part of it. People came through Buffalo across the river and into Fort Erie, separate, you know, through their own means, through other people, other safe homes, other ways that they were traveling across properties, other ways. Mama Moses was just one single facet of so many, and even in this town, in this region, there's statuary and plaques that commemorate several different ways, and none of those people interconnected, really. They were all doing it at different times, and there obviously was no communication back then, because everybody in Lewiston, for example, they never broke the code. Bounty hunters literally set up shop in Lewiston. They knew something was going on. And Josiah Tryon, while he was a Presbyterian minister, he also was a tailor, and this is famous, he would befriend the bounty hunters, because their bounty hunters were like basically hicks. They were hicks from down south. They had no sense of fashion. They had no sense of nothing. They were pretty rough and ready, just dirty guys. So he was always like, oh, you're a bounty hunter. Right on. We're always here to support them. How about I give you a gift of one of the finest new fashions? And he would give him this ridiculously loud, he was called the man of the rainbow heart, give him this ridiculously multicolored loud coat. And these bounty hunters were just like only too happy. Be like, check it out, new threads. Everyone in town knew. Whoa, look at the fucking guy. Sorry, but look at him. He's got the coat on. Don't even talk to him. Don't even go near him. Bounty hunter.
I love it. Oh,
yeah,
I love
fact.
It. That's still more yeah. trickster.
Yeah. Now, he's a crow. He's considered a crow, old crow. You know, Josiah Tryon, old man crow. Almost any time I take someone to that cemetery, I go by myself. You're only at his grave for less than a few minutes. And, right up on the top of the church that he was minister at, looking down, the crow.
We have to take another quick break. This is an episode that's going to really, really go down in the archives because we're covering such incredible information. I hope that this episode is, I hope people from all walks of life, students, researchers, historians, come and find this, because you are just covering so much that people don't know about. We're going to be returning for the third and final segment in just a few minutes. Thank you so much once again for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, brother.
When the sun comes back and the first quail calls, follow the drinking gourd, for the old man is waiting for to carry you to freedom. Follow the drinking gourd, follow.
Follow the drinking gourd.
the old man is a-waiting for. Can you, freedom, follow the drinking gold?
Listening to another fine production of the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ollie. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. This is the longest-running conjure show on the planet and may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner. Starring Candelo Cambisa and Malik Cambisa, this is the voice of authentic Cuban Palo and Dominican Sanse in the United States, with special guests representing the entire range of African traditional and diasporic religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Tuesdays, a pair of outstanding hosts point the way to essential values. First, on the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance in the practical use of crystals and crystal balls for the development of mental concentration, mind power, divination, and telepathic communication. His show airs Tuesday evenings from 5 to 6 o'clock Pacific Time. Once you have your bearings, engage in activism and social justice in the streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly brings listeners front-page reports on the ongoing struggle for racial, gender, and social justice, shedding much light on civil and social rights issues. Her cry for freedom begins at 6 p.m. Pacific Time and inspires us for 1 hour. On Wednesdays, Andrea Weston's Liquid Libations pour forth to bless us with poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances. If you are a poet or someone who simply enjoys the beauty and power of words, then Liquid Libations welcomes your participation. Call in and read your work. Listen for Liquid Libations on Wednesdays from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Pacific Time. On Thursdays, from deep in the heart of Texas, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the silver-tongued professor shares his knowledge of roots and delivers the lucky numbers. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern. Tax and license may apply. Train departure times and Burma Shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Lucky Mojo Curio Company is based in sunny Forestville, California, and provides traditional spiritual products for remediating all kinds of conditions. Locate them online at luckymojo.com or visit them in person. See the world's smallest church. Missionary, independent, spiritual. Welcome back to On Sacred Ground. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and today we have special guest, Witch Doctor Utu. We are discussing Harriet Mama Moses Tubman and the legacy of the Underground Railroad. We only have about 15 minutes left in the episode, but I want to, again, thank you so much for coming and sharing your knowledge and wisdom, Witch Doctor Utu. And I'd love to know, sort of from a personal experience, for anyone who might leave this episode and say, I'm feeling called to honor this, to venerate and honor Mama Moses, what would you suggest? How would, and you mentioned earlier, cornbread, hot food, cold food, water. Are there any other traditions or tools that people could use to contact this spirit, and for what reasons or for what conditions would you say she's most popularly called upon, and what kind of circumstances?
Yeah, well, the obvious one, I guess I should say obvious to some, is to free yourself, you know, to unshackle yourself of anything in life that is binding you, keeping you from getting to where you need to be. I have, over the last, you know, at least 15 years, seen people contact her invoke her, work with her, change their entire life direction. I mean, like everything from leaving marriages to jobs to moving to other regions to dealing with abuse to all those things. That's why she's so powerful. But it's not just her. And one of the ways, yes, of course, is offerings of cornbread and coffee and tea, anything that was sustenance, because to move on the Underground Railroad to eat, you know, obviously was a pretty good luxury. So, you know, to honor any spirit that went through hardship, sustenance and food, through prayer. The best, the piece of music you just played, Follow the Drinking Gourd, that is almost recited almost every time that I work with any of the spirits of the Underground Railroad. You recite the spirituals. You sing them. You recite certain prayers, from the Lord's Prayer to others, you know. You quote Mama Moses. There's many of her quotes. You know, you can read her actual words out loud. Read the spirituals. Read the codes. You know, people decorate their shrines at times with everything from the quilts, you know, that supposedly were invoked or used to have codes. Now, whether that's true or not is another question. My personal opinion is that while, you know, quilt work was definitely part of the African American experience on plantation and as a free people of color, it was a tradition. It's a tradition in the South as well, and just in general and throughout the North. It is a tradition. That it most likely happened after the Underground Railroad as commemoration, that people started to, because again, people debate that, oh, there was no such thing as quilt codes. But I've looked at them in numerous churches, numerous lodges, numerous spiritual houses of all African American, you know, conglomeration. They hang them. They use them. I use them. I like the patterns. You know, the other strange one is the lawn jockey, that an infamous little character that people see in their lawns, of the little black individual who's holding a lantern or holding the rein of a horse or something. You know, again, legend is that certain places in the North in particular, if one of those statues, which, you know, has its own whole history, going back to a myth of a slave that belonged to George Washington, because, of course, George Washington had lots of slaves, holding a lantern for them on their famous raid crossing the river, that he froze to death holding the lantern where the horses were. He never let, you know, job, and so a statue is commemorated in his honor. And this sort of like proliferated throughout parts of the Northeast, where these statues were placed in front of homes. They've now become these sort of derogatory individuals, where people say that's racist and get rid of them. But yet, I'm telling you, people collect those things and they place them on their shrines. I have a few of them. You know, I tend to repaint them and clean them up and not make them look like they're jockeys or whatever, but they hold lanterns for me. I bring them to places, to rituals. They do their job. They're little guys. They're almost like Preto Velos. You know, there's various, they're something that was made in Americana, and while they're not exactly the most celebrated in some circles, the fact is that it is reality that places, even in the Northeast right now, they still, the reason they have them, and now most of them are white, but regardless, some of the homes, when they're out there, especially in Lewiston, where it's a tradition, people have them outside of their homes holding lanterns, because that meant shining the light. And one of the things I wanted to sort of say, because I know we're running out of time, about Mama Moses is that it's not just working with her. It's who she brings with her. All right? So the Underground Railroad spirituality is almost at this point now, it's become sort of like a, in my mind anyways, amount of people that I've at least inspired, because I travel all year with the band, with the Dragon Ritual drummers, and with the Voodoo Shrine, that, you know, I have caused a lot of a change in effect out there. And so what it is, it's about commemorating those whose names have been forgotten as well. You know, so right here in St. Catharines, behind the British Methodist Episcopalian Church, there was a cemetery. Well, there is a cemetery, but it's not marked. It's a parking lot. It's right behind the most historic place in Canada where Mama Moses stood, talked, walked, preached, you know, planned, ate, you know, lived and slept. Right behind that building in a parking lot is bodies. The graves aren't there anymore, because the graves all through the Niagara region on this side predominantly were a cairn and a cross. And that's why that's the symbol. That's the conscious symbol of the Underground Railroad. It's a cairn and a cross with the North Star above it, and with a couple other things attached to it. But it's to recognize that that's why those graves don't exist, because they couldn't afford to have headstones. So when someone passed away after that entire journey of freedom to come and live here in freedom and then to die, and then your grave that your friends or your family built for you, which was a pile of rocks with a cross, eventually becomes discarded. It comes into ruin, and now those bodies lay there forgotten. So what the sort of the work that we do, the people that are in my tradition and the people that I communicate with the most, it's about guiding these spirits to their kin. Through the Mama Moses is a guide in the spirit world to people who are still wandering looking for freedom. This happens. There are spirits wandering of people who passed away trying to make it to freedom. And we're using the power of Mama Moses to guide those spirits to peace, to be with their fellow family members, to try to reunite family, to reunite kin, to reunite tribe. And so one of the stories, this story is told from South Carolina, North Carolina, all the way up to where I am now, and it's told sometimes at weddings. I've had people email me, call me, can you write this out for me? Because some people, you know, they choose to have this story told. And this is a fact, and this is an African-American tradition, again, regional. Good luck looking for it in books or whatever. I haven't seen it very much, but I certainly have met people that have told me the story slightly differently. But every single year, me and my gang, somewhere, whether it's in Canada or the United States, sometimes we do it more than once, we commemorate this story, and this describes everything. My temple is called the Niagara Voodoo Shrine. It has a presence on Facebook, and that's the house I live in. I live in the Niagara Voodoo Shrine. My home, from back door to front door, is an entire shrine to the spirits of the Underground Railroad. They're who I work with. It's where I live. But this story is the truth of a couple that was in love on the plantation, slaves. Okay, they were slaves, and they wanted to be married, and they knew they were going to escape. But they didn't want to have the slave wedding. They didn't want to jump that broom. They wanted to have a free wedding in Canada, and they wanted to do it as free people. So they embarked. They embarked on their journey with several other people to go and meet up with Mama Moses. They had at least enough knowledge, codes, paths to get to where they were going to meet her. And that party of people traveled for many moons, okay? And nobody knows why or how. No one knows their names. But this couple, the older lady, she became injured, like critically, and couldn't go any farther. They were in a remote swamp or a marsh, and she said, look, everybody keep going. I'm going to die here. And every time I tell the story, it's very emotional because it's so real. And so laying there in the swamp, her lover wouldn't leave, and he told them all to go. He was going to stay with her. And he embraced her, and they perished together in that swamp. And they are the reason that every year, people in my tradition, we marry them. We have a marriage ceremony so that we, whoever they are, through prayer, through memory, through commemoration, through just distant memory, that those people will be married, and they're married free every single year. Because they're the spirits that we work with the most, the ones who we don't know who their names are, the faith healers, her inner circle, we don't know who they are, you know. Right here in my town, I was given this beautiful gift of these photos that were found in an attic in a black family. And it's like hundreds of photos, man. And historians even tried to see, who are these people? They all posed for photos in downtown St. Catharines. They were all people that made it to freedom, or they were children of people that made it to freedom. And no one knows who they are. But somebody in my town kept them in their attic. It's a famous black family. They kept them in their attic, and they literally, they're all pin types, you know, those old things. And so who are these people? No one knows, but their images, I distribute them a little bit, and I was given permission to use them in my book so that people can see that, look, man, this is about also using Mama Moses and Frederick Douglass and John Brown and Levi Coffin, you know, all of these figures, and especially Mama Moses, to continue to guide the spirits to their resting place, to freedom, so that there's harmony, you know. So it's like a work that we're doing to make the spirit world that much a little more peaceful, a little more beautiful, and to finish off the job. The job isn't done yet. There's still spirits wandering, looking for freedom. And if they can see that lantern in the light, in the night, you know, shining from the distance, and if it's Mama Moses, and if our prayers and our songs can bring them together and show them where they can go, that's the work we're doing, and that's what I do.
And thank you so much for doing it. I can't say how much I'm touched by the work that you do, and how much it intersects with traditions that I work in and what I see as necessary. I often speak about the need to move spirits on and elevate spirits and get certain spirits, you know, going, because we are definitely living in a situation where
there's been a lot of trauma that's unresolved in our world, and it seems like you are working with some very beautiful, powerful spirits who did incredible work during their lives and are continuing to do that work after they've passed on. And I'm just completely in awe of what you're doing and of our world and of these lives of legends. Thank you again so much for coming in and sharing all of this incredible history and knowledge of tradition with us. When can we expect this book?
Well, that's to be determined. Don't know. There's been a couple of times where I thought it was going to be, but the problem is I have to basically pick a point to stop because I'm just almost daily, weekly inundated with other information because, people just constantly contact me or I meet other folks or more inspiration happens. It's, the whole thing's in motion. So it's really hard to be able to just say, I'm capping it right here. But I know since it'll be the first work of its kind that it's always going to be dissected after, expanded upon by others and so on and so forth. So that's my hardest part right now is to say, what part am I just going to say I'm done with this? It's going to have to be offered as is. But myself,
well, whatever we hear as On Sacred Ground can do to help, please let us know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for anyone that's going to hook up with me at the end of the day, they just got to go to DragonRitualDrummers.com, wherever the band is going to be, I'm going to be. As far as stuff that happens, I do a lot of open things here in the town I live in or the area that I live in. But in May 1st, the Dragon Ritual Drummers are going to be down in Florida for the Florida Pagan Gathering, and we're actually doing a big ritual there to commemorate Florida's unique contribution to the Underground Railroad because it was called the Other Underground Railroad. A whole other wave of folks went down into Florida as the Maroons and lived with the Seminole, in particular a famous Florida local conjure spirit I've worked with before, Uncle Monday. We're going to honor him. And so we'll be, because wherever I go, there's always somewhere. And then in August, I'll be at Hexfest with the Dragon Ritual Drummers in New Orleans, and we're going to be doing a ceremony to commemorate and to work with the spirits and remember those who actually helped from Louisiana, in particular New Orleans, to get people to freedom. And so those are the two places I'll be working specifically about that. And if anyone just looks me up on Facebook, my profile's open. They can contact me anytime, contact the Dragon Ritual Drummers, and they'll be able to find us and see what's going on or what's up,
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much for sharing those links and those resources. And I know that I myself would be trying to connect with you in the near future.
Setting lights to ensure that... You know there's a statue to Harry Tubman in your city in New York?
In New York City? I did not know that.
Yeah, right on Frederick Douglass Boulevard and St. Nicholas. I believe it's in Harlem, and it's right near a crossroads, and it's a huge statue commemorates Harry Tubman right in New York City.
I am going to have to go there this week. Thank you so much for that. And again, thank you so much for being such a knowledgeable, passionate guest. It's been so wonderful having you. Everyone, thank you so much for joining in, tuning in for this wonderful episode of Lives of Legend, focusing on Harriet Mama Moses General Tubman, a true inspiration. This has been another episode of On Sacred Ground. I'm your host, Kai Armand. Tune in next week as we continue to go deep into the heart of the human experience in which place plays a primary role. Until then, keep a light in your window for courage in our times, and I'll be keeping a light in mind. Thank you again.
Much love. Godspeed, my friend.
Godspeed.